Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined in the studio by 9/11 researcher and radio show host Gregory Longo. He's done a radio show called Speak Out on WBLQ out of Westerly, Rhode Island, for about 11 years, and primarily covers two taboo topics: what really happened on 9/11 and our entangled relationship with Israel. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Today we'll be talking about several topics, some related to both of these taboo subjects. I'm going to start our discussion today with a quote from Christopher Boleyn's book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And this is from page 24, and he states, quote, "An Israeli official named Oded Yanon revealed the Zionist strategy to balkanize the entire Middle East into ethnic mini-states in the early 1980s. The plan for a global, quote, war on terror to accomplish this goal has been articulated since the mid-1980s by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister of the extreme right-wing Likud party. The Israeli military's plans to realize these strategic goals were evidently in the works for at least 20 years before 9/11. And then in the same book on page 67, Boleyn explains further, quote, "To have the armies of the U.S. and European nations occupying Iraq, the most powerful and advanced Arab nation, has long been the dream of Zionist strategic planners. Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, has explicitly called for such a global, quote, war on terror since 1980, when his first book, International Terrorism, Challenge and Response, was published. Netanyahu's appeal for the Western democracies to wage war against Israel's foes was repeated and amplified in his 1986 book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win." So now let's look at some inconvenient truths of the connections between Israel and 9/11. Greg, maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about Larry Silverstein.
Well, one of the first things people ask about the Israeli connection to the events of 11 September is, well, who did it if it wasn't the 19 Arab hijackers? And some people say, well, maybe the first person we should check was Larry Silverstein would know. He's a best friend with Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli prime minister. Supposedly was in telephone contact once a week. On July 2001, he took out a $15 million lease on the whole World Trade Center complex, and the insurance covered attacks from terrorism, just exactly the attacks that occurred. And Larry Silverstein won a settlement for $5.6 billion. He was a regular member at Windows at the World at the top of the World Trade Center building, and that day he didn't go to eat breakfast, nor did his wife and children go. His wife told him that he had a dentist appointment that day. That's supposedly the rationale. So they weren't in the Trade Center buildings at the fateful day. He is also quoted as saying, when asked about how World Trade Center 7 came down, Larry Silverstein is quoted as saying, well, we had to pull it. This was on national television. That phrase pull it has been open to interpretation.
And the term pull it in the demolition industry means to bring the building down through controlled demolition, correct?
That's my understanding, yeah.
According to Christopher Boleyn, the Mossad has a long history of penetrating, infiltrating, and often manipulating Middle Eastern terror cells to serve their own purposes. And now I'm going to read you a little bit here from this Veterans Today article called Zim Shipping, Evidence They Knew 9/11 Was Coming. And in it, they have a discussion about the hijackers. And I'm just going to read you one of these. This is about Ziad Jarrah, one of the alleged hijackers. And it says, Jarrah came from an affluent Lebanese family and by just about all accounts was a non-political, non-devout Muslim brought up in private Catholic schools. Ziad's two Lebanese cousins, Ali and Yusuf Jarrah, were confessed and convicted spies for Israel. And it's likely that he could have recruited his cousin Ziad. Another interesting Israeli connection to 9/11 is the Zim American Israeli Shipping Company that was housed in World Trade Center 1, the North Tower, on 9/11. Greg, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that.
It's a good talking point, once again, about Israeli involvement in the events of 11 September 2001. The Zim Shipping Company was involved in the attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993. The bomb occurred in a parking lot owned by the Zim Shipping Company. Other interesting coincidences is that the bomb was in a Yellow Rider van, and it just happened that the FBI had operated that Rider van agency where the Rider truck was found and used for the bombing. Ralph Shoman's article, Who Bombed the World Trade Center 1993, is an excellent starting point for anybody who wants to know FBI involvement in this bombing. It's a classic example, to the best of my knowledge, of a false flag event, orchestrating the Arabs who were used, who rented the truck, went to the Rider agency to pick it up. The FBI gave them the truck, and the FBI told the alleged perpetrators that dummy explosives were going to be used. But, as we found out, real explosives were used. Typical FBI-operated other events where the FBI was involved in false flag events. Graham McQueen, a leading Canadian scholar for a Peace Institute in Canada, has been quoted as saying on the cover of Kevin Ryan's book, Another 19, also 9/11 related, that the FBI is the most corrupt agency in the American government. And this is from a scholar at the Peace Institute in Canada. But a lot of inconsistencies here. The person who rented the trucks actually came back four times to this agency and wanted the $400 deposit. Now, it sounds a little incongruous, I would think. And we can fast forward to 2001 and the involvement of the Zim Shipping Company in the World Trade Center bombs 2001. Also, the Zim Shipping Company was reported to have moved out of the World Trade Center on September 4th. They had finally cleared out of the World Trade Center, and they moved to North Fork, Virginia.
Yeah, and I understand it was a newly built office that they actually had to fast-track to get ready by September 4th. It says that they had signed the contract in March of 2001 to get it done. They said usually it takes twice that long to do, but they did that. And I also understand, and you can comment on this if you'd like, but that they had a lease going through 2006, this $8 million lease for the office space in the World Trade Center, which they gave up, losing money on this lease because it was good through 2006. And one of the reasons they said they were moving to the Norfolk, Virginia office was to save money. So there's some inconsistencies there also.
I do know that they supposedly gave up $50,000 as a penalty for moving out early. We just ran across, just within the last week or two, a lengthy report that you have in your hand right now on the Zim.
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit here. They did an assessment of Israeli intelligence. It's called the 1979 CIA Assessment of Israeli Intelligence, and it shows that the CIA has long suspected that Zim has been used for Israeli intelligence support and cover. The CIA Israeli assessment had this to say about Zim, quote, other Israeli government organizations that provide support to the Israeli intelligence and security community are the Ministries of Finance and Tourism, El Al, and the National Shipping Line, Zim. So, according to the CIA's own assessment, the Zim Shipping Company was a front for the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad, and around 9/11, there was some interesting activity involving the Zim Shipping Company. More food for thought. Now let's turn to the Dancing Israelis. Greg, could you tell us about them?
The Dancing Israelis were set up to film the event, as they would later state on Israeli television. After they spent 71 days in American prison, failed all the lie detector tests, these were five Israelis who filmed the event, had set up before the event happened, and it was witnessed. Concerned citizens called the police. The police tracked the five so-called dancing Israelis in an urban moving system van, which is a cover-up for a Mossad agency, arrested them. They, like I said, failed the lie detector test, and after 71 days in American prison, were quietly released back to Israel, where they got on television and quoted as saying, "We were there to document the event." And the dancing Israelis, one of them was caught, was $4,700 in a sock. The van tested positive for explosives.
And in another interesting turn of events, the owner of the Urban Moving Systems was Dominic Suter. And he moved back to Israel shortly after 9/11. And most people probably remember that on 9/11 and for a few days after, all domestic and international air transportation was grounded in the U.S. And we heard about the flight that was allowed to leave during that period, the flight filled with bin Laden family members and associates. I think people have heard about that, but they maybe haven't heard about the El Al flight that was allowed to leave the country. And maybe you can tell us about that, Greg.
And we got that information from Wayne Madsen. He's an investigative reporter. He said this was many years after the event took place that this information came out about a fully loaded El Al, which is Israeli, 747, took off on 9/11 from JFK Airport to Tel Aviv. This was after the Federal Aviation Administration grounded all civilian, domestic, and international incoming and outgoing flights to and from the United States. The flight departed at 4:11 p.m. on 11 September, according to Madsen's El Al sources. And the flight was authorized by the direct intervention of the U.S. Department of Defense. U.S. military officials were on the scene at JFK and were personally involved with the airport and air traffic control authorities to clear the flight for takeoff. And according to the 9/11 Commission report, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta ordered all civilian flights to be grounded at 9:45 a.m. on September 11th. And like I said, people interested in the events of that day, I don't think, got this information until, you know, 6 years later.
Right. And it's interesting that the information about the bin Laden family members got out there, but this did not. It seems to me that we're being pushed into blaming Muslims for 9/11, when in fact there is much more evidence linking Israel and our own government to 9/11 than it is the Muslims. It's only through the hijackers that we now know may not even be real. You know, there's no evidence the hijackers were on those planes, and seven of them say they're still alive. So that story kind of falls through.
Continuing on with the so-called mainstream media, we have other definitions of our media. But I remember on day one, 11 September, being very angry with the media and its demonization of Arabs, Muslims, on that day. Just like the Oklahoma City bombing, they were the mainstream media and U.S. media was demonizing Arabs before the official story came out that it was Timothy McVeigh. And we're not even sure of that, actually. There's a lot of information about the Oklahoma City bombing with four unexploded bombs in the Mura building, or what remained of the Mura building, and the fact that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms didn't show up for work that day, the day of the bombing.
Yeah, and there's actually a group out there that is really trying to get people to pay attention to that, but since it didn't have the worldwide implications that 9/11 does, they're not having as much success in getting people to pay attention to them. But there's as many anomalies and questions about the Oklahoma City bombing as there are 9/11. And they do have a movie out called A Noble Lie, which explores some of the anomalies and discrepancies with the official account of what happened that day.
And I think that movie came out around the time of 11 September 2001, so obviously if it wasn't going to get any publicity, it was certainly would have been overrided by the events of that day.
So I do want to mention that as we explore the evidence of the Israeli connection to 9/11, that it's evidence. We're exploring the evidence and the facts as we know them, and this is not anti-Semitic, so I just want to point that out to people. This is just following the evidence, and we criticize our own government, and we're criticizing or questioning the Israeli government, and it is not anti-Semitic. So if anyone's going in that direction, I just want to point that out, that that is not the case. It's simply following the evidence. And I do think that the 9/11 Truth Group self-censors on this issue. And so I think it's important to put it out there. 9/11 is very important. It has really international consequences, dire, grave international consequences. So it's really important that people know these facts. So that said, Greg, could you talk at all about, to give people sort of a little background and context to these issues, could you talk a little bit about the Levon affair?
The Levon affair, or a shameful affair, as it has been known in Hebrew, was an Israeli false flag terror bombing campaign against the United States and Britain and was carried out in Egypt in 1954. Israeli military intelligence had set up a terror cell of sleeper agents in Egypt, which was activated in July 1954 to blow up U.S. and British targets. The Israeli operation was codenamed Susanna. The false flag terrorist bombings were meant to be blamed on Egypt in order to alienate the U.S. and Britain from President Gamal Abdel Nasser and prevent Egypt from nationalizing the Suez Canal. The Levon affair is seldom discussed in the media or in university courses on Middle Eastern history. Strict censorship in the Israeli media even prevented the Israeli public from knowing about the affair for many years. Only in 2005, 51 years after the bombings, did Israel finally admit responsibility for the 1954 terrorist bombing campaign in Egypt. The bombings were carried out between July 2nd and July 27th, 1954, by a covert terror cell composed of about one dozen Egyptian Jews under the command of Israeli intelligence agents. And if it's not obvious, I was reading that, and that comes from a book by Christopher Bolin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And he has a website, which is very exhaustive.
And I just want to take a moment to remind people of the Project for a New American Century, or the PNAC, the PNAC as we call it. And this was a think tank, a neoconservative think tank, created in the 90s, and it called for U.S. hegemony or full-spectrum dominance over the world by the U.S. And a majority of the members of this organization had close ties to Israel, and some were even dual Israeli-U.S. citizens. There were also some Americans in there from our own government involved in this. And they called for this full-spectrum dominance, and they said that the American people wouldn't buy into this because it meant a large increase in the military budget, absent a, quote, new Pearl Harbor. And then we get 9/11, and they went full speed ahead with their invasions of countries and putting in the Patriot Act. And actually, this think tank put this plan before Clinton with the invasion of Iraq, and he told them, no, forget it. So under George Bush, they got their way. After 9/11 happened and gave them their new Pearl Harbor to exploit, and by the way, they're still very powerful in Washington today. And now I just want to read something again, from Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11. This one is called The Original Articles. It's a companion book to the Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And here goes. Andreas von Bülow, the former German parliamentarian, served on the commission which oversees the three branches of the German Secret Service from 1969 to 1994. Von Bülow said that he believed that the Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, was behind the 9/11 terror attacks. These attacks, he said, were carried out to turn public opinion against the Arabs and boost military and security spending. You don't get the higher echelons, von Bülow said, referring to the architectural structure, which masterminds such terror attacks. At this level, he said, the organization doing the planning, such as Mossad, is primarily interested in affecting public opinion. In a classic false flag terror attack, the architectural level planners will use unwitting or corrupt guns for hire in order to have the blame assigned to the desired target. The terrorists who actually carry out the crimes are what von Bülow calls the working level, such as the 19 Arabs who allegedly hijacked the planes on September 11. The working level is part of the deception, he said. 95% of the work of the intelligence agencies around the world is deception and disinformation, von Bülow said. The deception is then widely propagated in the mainstream media, creating an accepted version of events. Journalists don't even raise the simplest questions, he said. Those who differ are labeled as crazy.
One of the more telling quotes that really got me to study more about Israeli involvement in the events of 11 September was a quote by a former premier of Italy, Francesco Cossiga. who said in late 2006, it's common knowledge among the global intelligence community that the planners and perpetrators of the events of 9/11 were the American CIA and the Israeli Mossad. And then you had at the time books by Jimmy Carter coming out in 2006, Peace Not Apartheid, and you also had the Walt Mersheimer book, The Israel Lobby, and maybe James Petras' book, also late 2006, The Power of Israel in the United States. It's one of the first of five books he later published about the entangled relationship between the United States and Israel.
So there's a large body of research that certainly links Israel to 9/11, and we've only shared a small portion of that with you today. And of course, you just heard Greg's quote by Francesco Cossiga. And so parts of the U.S. government also would have had to have been involved for this to happen, for everybody's involvement, all the government agencies that failed that day. And certainly it looks like Cheney may have been involved with his actions in the emergency bunker under the White House. And they may have been working with other intelligence agencies around the world, but the CIA and the Mossad seem like the key players there. As I said, the 9/11 Truth Movement tends to censor this topic. And with the world hotspots continuing to burn and the situation in Iraq rapidly deteriorating, I think it's important to discuss these mostly censored topics. If you want to listen to Gregory Longo's radio show, it's called Speak Out. It's at WBLQ out of Westerly, Rhode Island. If you go to the website www.wblq.net, so www.wblq.net, on Sunday evenings from 6 to 7 p.m., you can listen live to Gregory talking about these issues. And he also plays some really good music along with it. Gregory, anything else you want to say to our listeners before we pause today?
I would like to mention the book by Jeff Gates also. It's called Guilt by Association, How Deceit and Self-Deception Took America to War. And he's also the author of two other books, The Ownership Solution and Democracy at Risk. They came out around 2000, and the Guilt by Association came out in 2008.
Okay, Greg, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Cheryl.
If you'd like more information on Israeli involvement in the events of September 11, 2001, a few good sources are Christopher Vollin's book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and then Victor Thorne, who writes for the American Free Press, has books and articles available from the American Free Press website, and the articles and radio shows of Dr. Kevin Barrett. They can be accessed through the website Veterans Today. And I would encourage you to check this information out for yourself. Another great website to follow what's really happening around the world is globalresearch.ca. It's a Canadian website, and I'm going to read an article posted there on July 5th, 2014, about a new documentary they produced called ISIL and the So-Called Caliphate, Israeli-U.S. Tools to Divide Iraq. And it's written by Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. And here goes. The following Global Research TV documentary looks at the crisis in Iraq. This short documentary examines the support that the U.S. and Israel are providing to the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, which used to call itself al-Qaeda in Iraq and more recently calls itself the Islamic State and its self-declared, quote, caliphate. Audiences are presented with past analysis from the Center for Research on Globalization by Mahdi Darius Nazemroya and Michelle Chusadovsky, that connects the dots between the two crises in Iraq and Syria and the long war of the U.S. that is ultimately aimed at controlling Eurasia. The division of Iraq and the Middle East is part of a long-standing push into Eurasia by the U.S., Israel, and their allies that has consistently involved a set of pretexts and lies. Sectarian hatred between Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims and between Kurds and Arabs is now falsely being presented as the basis for the conflicts in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. military cannot go into any country that it desires for regime change. This is why Washington has applied other techniques for regime change. In 2006, with the failure of the U.S. to break the resistance bloc or axis of resistance in the Middle East, the U.S. began its, quote, redirection policy and opted to use insurgencies, sectarianism, color revolutions, and intensified covert operations. One of the people that set the stage for the division of Iraq is Joseph Biden, the current Vice President of the United States. When Biden was a U.S. Senator in the U.S. Congress, he presented the Biden plan to divide Iraq into three sectarian entities in 2008. In part, the Biden plan created one of the blueprints for the political face of the current crisis in Iraq. The U.S. also wants the federal government in Iraq to be replaced because it refused to help the U.S. and its allies in the war against Syria. Its alliance with Iran, Iraq's growing trade and purchases of military hardware from the Russian Federation, and Iraqi oil sales to China. Because of Washington's desire for regime change in Baghdad and its plans to divide Iraq, the U.S. government has been delaying aid to the Iraqi government. Russia and Belarus, on the other hand, have stepped in to militarily help Baghdad alongside Iran and Syria. While the U.S. is covertly supporting the division in Iraq, Israel has overtly been supporting this, as outlined by the Yanan plan. After the ISIL's 2004 offensive inside Iraq began, Iraqi officials reported that the Israelis were present in Iraqi Kurdistan and also involved in assisting the ISIL fighters inside Iraq's borders. Tel Aviv has even openly told Washington to let the different groups in Iraq kill one another, just like Iran and Iraq were doing during the Iraq-Iran war. While Israel refuses to allow or recognize Palestinian independence, Israeli officials have called for the international community to recognize the dismemberment of Iraq by recognizing Iraqi Kurdistan as a separate republic. This is because Israel plans on using the Kurdish people as pawns and Iraqi Kurdistan as a regional outpost. The Kurdistan Regional Government has used the ISIL's 2014 offensive as an opportunity to take over the multi-ethnic and oil-rich Iraqi city of Kirkuk and to announce that it plans to declare independence from Iraq. In part, petropolitics and control over energy is tied to the Kurdistan Regional Government's plans of secession and its armed takeover of Kirkuk, which it has claimed as its historic capital. The Turkish government has already been making illegal energy deals with the leaders of the Kurdistan Regional Government for Iraqi oil. Reports are also surfacing that Israel will buy Iraqi oil from the Kurdistan Regional Government via Turkey. With the takeover of Kirkuk, Iraqi oil will be sent to the Turkish port of Ceyhan, which is the Eastern Mediterranean export terminal for the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, which not only gives Israel access to Iraqi oil, but also endangers Eurasian energy integration and the Banias-Kirkuk pipeline running from Iraq to Syria. The Iraqi and Syrian people must stand united in the face of the project to divide their ancient societies and cultures. And again, that's an article from the website globalresearch.ca. And you can see this documentary there also. And now I'm going to end the show by reading just a few paragraphs of another article from the Global Research website called The Islamic State, the, quote, Caliphate Project and the Global War on Terrorism, by Professor Michelle Chusadovsky. And this is to make the connection to 9/11 and why it's so important to get at the truth of that event. So here goes. The Al-Qaeda legend and the threat of the, quote, outside enemy is sustained through extensive media and government propaganda. In the post-9/11 era, the terrorist threat from Al-Qaeda constitutes the building block of U.S.-NATO military doctrine. It justifies, under a humanitarian mandate, the conduct of, quote, counterterrorism operations worldwide. Known and documented, Al-Qaeda-affiliated entities have been used by U.S.-NATO in numerous conflicts as, quote, intelligence assets since the heyday of the Soviet-Afghan War. In Syria, the al-Nusra and ISI rebels are the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, which in turn oversees and controls the recruitment and training of paramilitary forces. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.